Our speaker this afternoon is Ray West. He has researched the unregulated material available on the internet, and he's going to talk about how this raises major issues concerning free speech. It's a very important topic, and we're grateful to Ray that he's going to talk to us on this, the internet and Holocaust revisionism.
Thanks. Okay, I'm sorry it was such a small audience, actually, but thanks for coming anyway. Okay, now I'm going to read through my script, which will take me some time. The timing should be okay. Right, that's a complicated and controversial subject. I don't think anybody deny that. But I'll do my best to plow right through it with sensational results. Now, let me just start with an account here. I'll start with two accounts. This is one from 1965. According to the New York Times of October the 3rd, 1965, there have been 170,000 civilians killed, 800,000 maimed by torture, 5,000 burnt alive, disemboweled or beheaded, 100,000 killed or maimed by chemical poisons, 400,000 detained and tortured savagely. One method of torture used by American troops is partial electrocution or frying, as one United States advisor called it, by attaching live wires to male genital organs or the breasts of Vietnamese women prisoners. That's quote one. Quote two is, already 8 million villagers are living in 6,000 hamlets, so far completed with bamboo fences, barbed wire, and armed militiamen. Right, so what's the relevance of that? We'll see later. Now, I want to survey what I'm going to do on the principle of telling you what I'm going to tell you. Right? First of all, I'll comment on the internet, which is the source of this talk. I want to make it clear that I'm not sort of obsessed by this subject. I only became aware of its existence a couple of months ago, in fact. And many of the things that I found on it came as a surprise to me, and I'll indicate these during my talk. I'll flag them, I'll mention them. I'll also supplement internet with a few publications of the typical sort that anybody can get in second-hand shops and so on. I'll also comment on free speech and some of the issues around it, including technology, and I'll try not to be too banal about such a topic. And I also want to look into revisionism as a concept and then home in onto Holocaust revisionism and looking at various types of revisionists. Then I'll go into the details of all the personalities involved in it, and starting with the revisionists and then the anti-revisionists. And then I'll have to look at the Nuremberg Tribunal and try and summarise the evidence brought by revisionists and also by the anti-revisionists. And I'll try and end up with a kind of summary, including political comments and so on. I think some of them are addressed to the left, if there are any here. Right, on the internet, opinions of it vary. Christopher Hitchens said that it's tremendously oversold. You'll get oligopolies and consumerist hogwash, and he likes print. John Pilger said that the internet is controlled by American government and multinationals, although he thinks it's a wonderful thing. I should point out, for the benefit of people who've never used it, that it's quite a difficult thing to use. Skilled computer people are able to store the stuff on their computers for use later, but unskilled ones find this very difficult. And in my view, the promotional campaigns of organisations like the BBC, their computers don't bite, are very misleading. And I've seen adults go into rages of frustration trying to get these things to work. There's also the danger of losing all your work and so on. In practice, most internet users belong to institutions. They're typically students or employees of big companies who offload the costs onto their organisations, in effect. Many sites are maintained not by people whose names appear on them, as you might expect, but by associates or friends or whatever. And instead, you'll often be told the quality of the material on the internet is poor. In my opinion, this is not true. It's a purely verbal medium. There's no way of making your points other than through well-chosen words, and the standard is generally not at all bad. And incidentally, there's a subset of internet, which a lot of people don't know about, called Usenet, which has several thousand interest groups, all like a bit like special interest magazines dealing with individual topics. Right, let's go through it. Now, on free speech, in my opinion, the amazing thing is that there's such an ideology exists at all. you'd expect any group that's achieved any sort of dominance to oppose free speech, and generally this is true. And, you know, roughly speaking, without trying to be too precise, you can divide a population into, say, into, roughly speaking, well-off or established and not and poor, and also into intelligent and not intelligent. And established people generally cannot be expected to favour free speech. And I quote George V as an example, who said that people who write books ought to be shut up. That was his contribution to culture. And many important intellectual exchanges have only been introduced by, you know, sort of indigent, intelligent people, like, for example, Faraday. And I think this is the pragmatic argument for free speech, namely that something useful might come out of it. But in practice, free speech is a bit of a dead letter, and one might quote this organisation as an example, in fact, somnolent and moribund as it is. Because as far as I know, in all its 100 years, nobody here has ever spoken on, for example, on the financial resources of the Church of England. So with critics like this, establishments can rest easy, can't they? Right, anyway, there's nothing special in having a slogan which with little content. I mean, for example, democracy is more of a slogan than reality. And free trade, of course, tends to be a cover for pushing strong economies onto another. And similarly, there's an analogy with free speech, which may just be a cover for kind of pushing pornography or whatever. Now, many of the theoreticians of free speech are much more restrictive than is usually realised. For example, Milton's Areopagitica, which is generally according to Chomsky, advocates licensing of books rather than anything that you'd normally consider free speech. And John Stuart Mill is another example. He would not, for example, allow the view that Victoria should be assassinated, even by somebody conscientiously convinced it would be a good thing. So generally, free speech is conceived in rather vague terms. I think it's fair to say that nobody's yet come up with a theory that adequately deals with it. It's still an open issue. And there's a problematical issue. You might take secrecy in banking, which seems to be even more secure than governance, as far as I can tell. You know, with governance, you get 30 or 100-year rules or whatever on documents which are permitted to still exist. But banks haven't any obligation to publish papers, as far as I know. Now, I want to get on to technological change. One of the very important determinants of free speech is technological change. For example, at the time of the Levellers, they managed to break up the stationers' company monopoly, I think mainly because printing was becoming cheaper and easier. And same way, there's a widespread belief that the Dutch in the 17th century were useful as permitting publication of books banned in Britain. But in my view, this was a mistake. It's a technological thing. The Dutch prince had spare capacity, and demand for books in Dutch was obviously rather limited. So some English chap with a bag of gold wanting a couple of hundred copies of a book on how terrible the Archbishop of Canterbury was would be an attractive proposition to them. Nothing much to do with free speech. And I think the same is true with internet. The providers of it want to make money or lose less money, in fact, I think is what usually happens. Now, another importance of technology is what makes it important is because it looks reliable. The most up-to-date type of technology looks more reliable than outdated stuff. For example, at the time of the First World War, English people believed newspapers, which were then, you know, at the peak of their thing, was reliable as encyclopedias, and that must have been a sort of factor in promoting the war. Later on, radio was the important thing, and you find, for example, people like Bernard Shaw, when he wasn't writing in his garden shed, listened to his radio most of the time. I think this attitude still exists, particularly in elderly people, who imagine that the 1 o'clock BBC news is a sort of apex of accurate communication. Well, I've often noticed that. Okay, now, on revisionism as a concept, as far as I can tell, this has originated with Marxism, Lenin being the first revisionist. And there are also religious revisionists who consider, for example, whether Jesus Christ ever lived. It's also extended into other historical fields. If, for example, you look at the Second World War, you find what you might call left-wing revisionists who look, for example, at Standard Oil of New Jersey, which is supposed to supply Germany with quarter of its oil throughout the war. I haven't established whether that's true. Or Opel, the German branch of General Motors, which helped make German armoured cars. And I'll quote Tony Benn here from a talk he gave here. I think it's time we did a bit of... I won't attempt his accent. I think it's time we did a bit of re-examination, you know, of the 1930s and got away from the idea that the British government believed in appeasement. They didn't appease Hitler. They supported Hitler. They backed Hitler. And his evidence was that captured German Foreign Office documents showed that when Halifax went to talk to Hitler, the first thing he did was congratulate the German Chancellor on having destroyed communism in Germany and acting as a bulwark against it in Europe. And Ben went on to say the whole of that 1930s period was a period when Western governments were happy to use fascism in order to destroy socialism in all its forms. That's one type of revisionism. There's another type of revisionism I might take here. Robert Blake, the Disraeli biographer, Why Britain Went to War, is an article, and he said, it would be nice to say that Britain fought for ideals, democracy, freedom, the rule of law, etc., but it would be untrue. Britain fought because government and people believed that its existence as a great imperial power was threatened. And there's an American revisionist, Gabriel Kolko, who wrote mostly about the American Empire. He flourished in the 60s. Right, now that's... OK, that's revisionism. Now, until recently, I'd more or less ignored what I'd consider to be right-wing revisionists on the grounds that it must be a bunch of nonsense. But in fact, at least on the internet, the word revisionism is now used to apply almost entirely to Holocaust revisionism. For example, there's a Usenet site called alt.revisionism, which is devoted entirely to this topic. It has nothing else except Holocaust revisionism and, you know, closely related topics. Right, so what happens if you look on internet at the key phrase, Holocaust revisionism? What I should do for orientation is just try and summarise what the revisionists claim in common. This is what they all say. This is a subset that more or less unites revisionists. They're actually quite simple. They claim that a deliberate extermination policy of Jews didn't exist. That's claim number one. They also claim that gas chambers are a myth. And they also claim that although lots of Jews died, I think it's fair to say that they're claiming that the deaths weren't proportionally more than other groups like Czechs, Poles, Ukrainians, Russians, Baltic people, and so on and so on. And there are others as well, of course, like a quarter of all British merchant seamen, I think. So those are the key beliefs, I think. But many other issues get dragged in, as you might expect, and many of them are very well-established taboos. But since we're in a sort of temple to rationalism, I'll try and list a few of them, which the things which normally don't get mentioned. Taboo number one is whether Jews actually are descended from Jews. The second one is a business about Jews taking a special part in the Bolshevik Revolution, at least originally. And also the question of whether Judaism and things like the Talmud and so on counts as a fundamentalist ideology. And as an example of the taboo, you can look at E.H. Carr's series of books on the Bolshevik Revolution, which came out in around about the 1950s, which virtually doesn't mention Jews at all, despite purporting to be serious history. A bit like discussing Yugoslavia without, former Yugoslavia, without mentioning Muslims and Christians. Okay, now, these are the views that these people have. I'll try and go through and... first of all, I'll look at the motivations, right? I'll try and group them by motivations rather than the people. And there's a whole list, and there's about 10 categories of revisionists, which are kind of distinctively separate. Some of them are, I should say, purely anti-Semitic. For example, they post lists of what famous people have said about Jews, and favourites seem to be people like Voltaire, Henry Ford, George Washington, Mark Twain. That's one lot. Some of them are more anti-Zionist rather than anti-Semitic or pro-Palestinian. And there's a group called Radio Islam of this sort, and I'll talk more about them later because that's quite an important group. Another group is German extraction Americans. I remember reading in an American paper about a third of all Americans in the US claim German ancestry, whatever that's supposed to mean. Of course, such people have a motivation for not being anti-German. And they're also what seem to be white Russian or Polish types who consider Bolsheviks were Jewish, and you get Catholics coming into that. The exemplar earlier on being Hilaire Belloc, you know, the Catholic who wrote his book, The Jews, that was in 1922. And they're also anti-communists, as you might expect, given that the internet is largely American, who put stress more on Stalin than on Hitler. And there are also miscellaneous organisations, including Protestant fundamentalists, people like Louis Farrakhan and other and various black Americans, quite a few of whom seem to dislike American Jews. And there are also whites, there's kind of white, I'm not sure if you can call them racists, but they're whites who think their power is slipping. And it's rather odd, it may seem strange to think of the 1930s as a golden age, but from their point of view in those days, you know, American cars were the best thing in the world, the blacks were in their place, and so on and so on. So from their point of view, the world has changed for the worse. You know, you've got there's another site run by a chap called Hoffman that looks at other neglected aspects of history, like, for example, white slavery in the US, things like children in chimneys and so on. And there are also groups which consider fairly taboo Second World War issues, like the connection between Zionism and the Third Reich and so on. And you'd expect common sense, which is just that there must be Polish or Hungarian and South American groups and so on, but if so, there's not much of it on the internet. And finally, there are, at least I imagine there are, people who are genuinely interested in truth and history, which I consider myself to be. And I'll concentrate really on the people that I consider to be in this lattermost group. Right, now, here we come to surprise number one, namely how old all this is. It's not a new thing at all. Right, now, the first revisionists appeared at the same time as the Nuremberg Tribunal, which started in November 1945. And ended in 1949, producing in the process 22 volumes of hefty transcript. So this is not a new phenomenon, although it might appear that way. Okay, now the second surprise is how industrious some of these people are, some of these revisionists are. They've been doing it for years, and they've accumulated a lot of stuff. For instance, there's a Swede called Dietrich Felderer, who has, or claims he has, 30,000 slides, some of them infrared, and all sorts of measurements and so on, taken at all the concentration camps. There's a Frenchman called Fourisson, who seems to have spent years following up reports and interviewing people, or trying to interview them, like the author of the Diary of Anne Frank, the father of the, you know, Diary of Anne Frank. Another example is David Irving, who's well known as a self-trained document historian, who's got mountains of documents, and he's supposed to have a card index of 10,000 separate items. That's perhaps out of date now, it might be more by now, arranged by date, so that he can see what's happening at any date that he's interested in. I should add that Irving doesn't claim to be a Holocaust revisionist, strictly speaking. The Holocaust, from his point of view, is a sort of byproduct of all his work on the original documents. But with that proviso, I'll include him in here, since his work on the biographies of Hitler and Churchill and his recent book on Goebbels, which seems to have been banned, is obviously relevant. He's, in fact, somewhat looked down on by some Holocaust revisionists on the grounds that even as late as 1977, in his book Hitler's War, he believed in the Holocaust. So he's looked down on. Okay, now let's look at the various people involved. Okay, the first name I want to mention is Professor Paul Racinier. He's a Frenchman who's now dead, who was in concentration camps for much of the war. Now, he was a socialist, or depending on your taste, depending on your point of view, he was a socialist who turned to fascism after the war, or he was a socialist who didn't believe accusations made against the Germans, and published quite a few books on the subject, and he had experience, of course, having been in concentration camps. So far as I've been able to find out, his first book was in 1949, called Le Mensonge d'Ulysses, Ulis thing about, there's a classical thing that runs through these people for some reason, to do with the voyages of Ulysses, the suggestion being that there's a whole collection of exaggerations and lies. The only book of his, as far as I've established, translated to English, is called The Drama of the European Jews, which was translated in 75 by Harry Elmer Barnes, who was a sociologist from Chicago University. Okay, Rassinier also wrote on the Eichmann trial, and he started, along with somebody called Bardèche, what I might as well call the French school, which includes Robert Fourisson, who was famous. He's from Lyon, fairly famous. He was the one whose book had a preface in France on free speech, signed by 100 people, including Chomsky, and for which Chomsky received endless attacks. The other 99 seemed to have been more or less ignored. And Chomsky incidentally said that he never read the book and didn't know anything in detail about the subject. His sole motivation for writing the thing was to support his Fourisson's free speech right off.
Right.
Now, Rassinier was important on Fourisson because, according to Fourisson, he would reply in detail to Fourisson's letters when all the anti-revisionists were evasive and wouldn't answer him and so on. Another Frenchman is a chap called Garaudy, who's described as an ex-Marxist theoretician. He was a kind of communist who converted to Catholicism and is now some sort of Holocaust revisionist. It's a rather strange mixture there. Incidentally, I should say, in France now, under the what's called the Geiso-Fabius law, passed in 1990, it's a criminal offence. And I quote, this must be in French originally, but it's a criminal offence in France now to contest by any means the existence of one or more of the crimes against humanity as defined by Article 6 of the Statute of the International Military Tribunal, and so on, 1945. Now, Fourisson is a professor of literature. I don't know what the professor means in France. I don't know what that status actually means.
Teacher, as in professor.
A teacher.
This professor just means a teacher, doesn't
he? He's at the university, though.
Oh.
He's a university, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, his writings don't, from my point of view, look very well in it. They don't seem to translate very well, and he pays a lot of attention to documentary auditors, being a literature chap. He likes to look at documents. However, as far as I can establish, he was the very first person to assert in print, sort of definitively, that gas chambers were a myth. I don't think anybody else did that. Well, I may be wrong about that. Okay, now as far as I know, there's no German school at all, because in Germany and Austria, the entire topic is banned under a law which apparently was passed by Hitler. As far as I can gather, this law prohibits any discussion of the Holocaust, which is on the grounds it's a historical fact. It's stated to be a fact which is sort of unchallengeable. But there are isolated Germans who produce things, including a chap called Wilhelm Steglich, who was a judge, who published a book called The Auschwitz Myth in 1979. There's also a chap called Ugo Volendi, who I think is German, who's published on fake photos, what he says are fake photos. And there are also several historians of the Second World War in Germany. You've received various amounts of stick. Right, now, as far as I can gather, English revisionists are rather unimportant as regards original work. And there was a book called Did 6 Million Really Die, published in 1974, which was, in fact, published pseudonymously by somebody with the name given being Richard Harwood, but apparently it was a London University graduate called Verrill, and perhaps other people as well. And it was reviewed by Colin Wilson, the sort of occultist chappy, in Books and Bookmen in the same year, in 1974, which apparently caused months of controversy. But the sources, as far as I can gather, are mostly from French material, so the importance there, if there is any, as a translator rather than an original worker. And there's another chap worth mentioning in Britain is somebody called Dr. Russell Burton, who was a medical doctor who was in Belsen in 1945, and he was commissioned to write an article in something called Purnell's History of the Second World War, in which he maintained that the deaths there were caused by intense overcrowding. He said there were 53,000 people retreating from the Polish front, whatever, in a camp designed for 3,000, and there was typhus. as far as I can gather, Burton is not a revisionist in that usual sense. He accepts the usual figures for Jewish deaths, but I don't think he accepts gas chambers. Right, now, as regards to the USA, because of the important part played by the US and the Nuremberg Tribunal, I think doubts emerged very early on between 1947 and 51. I'll look at that later. And there are several books which emerged in the post-war period. One of them was somebody called David Hogan, who was a professor of history in 1969, and one by a chap called Austin App in 73. But these books, one gathers, are not very good. The most important one, as far as I've been able to establish, is one by Arthur Butts, who was a chemical engineer, still is now, as far as I know, who published in a very obscure publisher in 1975 a book called The Hoax of the 20th Century, and his methodology was to get original documents. I think he taught himself to, or already knew how to read German. He got the documents or copies of them through the US interlibrary loan systems, which of course, being an academic, he could do. And he spent a lot of spare time working on this. His book has a lot of material involving American politics in particular. Now, Butts has got a site on the internet, but his book can't be downloaded. I think perhaps he's still selling it. At least it's not available by that mechanism. Although, to my surprise, it was on the Surrey public library computer system, to my rather amazement. Anyway.
Right, so what do you mean by downloading?
Oh, downloading. Oh, everybody also downloading. It just means that you plug into the thing and you read it and it comes down the telephone line. Anyway, you can't do that with his book. His book is not available sort of publicly. You have to buy it or photocopy it or something. Anyway, the important thing about Butts is he's a chemical engineer. He's got a chemical engineering background. And he took a long look at the technical side of Auschwitz, which he considers to be a manufacturing plant, Auschwitz being an important coal centre and important for the point of view of synthesising hydrocarbons, you know, synthesising oil. It's the kind of thing that historians generally, because of the technology, don't know much about. They're not able to do this kind of thing.
But it was originally, there's a site called Monobitz or Monobitz, which
is... that's right. Okay, anyway, as far as I know, no legal action has been taken in the US. As far as I know, in the US, all this is accepted, although I believe Clinton is being approached to kind of chop it down. Anyway, now, the surprise number three is how obscure all these people are in this dispute. You might, in a sense, a very few are kind of official historians on either side. You might expect that the sort of supposedly heavyweight historians like people like Alan Buller or, you know, Trevor Roper, Lord Dacre or Hobsbawm would kind of weigh in from their Olympian heights. And since the received impression is they've got enormous amounts of evidence which they could easily produce, and you might imagine this would happen, but in fact it doesn't. Most of the people are obscure. Now, that's the kind of look at the sort of schools. I mean, there's, as you'd expect in Germany, there's not much. There's quite a lot in England, France, and America. However, one of the most important sites from the internet point of view is in Canada. It's one of the largest sites. It's because of a chap called Ernst Zundel, who's a naturalized German. He was born in 1939 and experienced a certain amount of bombing and so on. And he lives in Toronto, and he's got a site which he calls the Zundel site. I'll anglicise it as Zundel site. And this has got the complete text of "Did 6 million really die?" on it, which, in fact, what happened was that Zundel started to distribute this in 1980 in Canada, and was variously prosecuted. As a result of that, there was a trial, and he was tried twice, in fact. One of them was on appeal. One of them was in 1985, which went on for 7 weeks, and then there was one in 1988, which went on for 4 months. It's about the same time as Mordecai Vanunu was abducted. So there's a kind of all these things going on at the same time. As far as I can gather, this lawsuit was brought by somebody called Sabina Citroen, who was a wealthy woman with furniture money, I think, or something, of an organisation called the Canadian Holocaust Remembrance Association, and also Simon Wiesenthal. Anyway, the importance of this from the internet point of view is that you can get the transcript of this trial on internet, and it's got five very long testimonies, major testimonies, each about 400,000 characters long, 400K, as we say. That's about half the length of a novel of, about the length of, say, Lord Jim, each of them. So you've got five pieces of testimony like that, so there's an awful lot of it, and there's plenty of other short ones too. And the main prosecution ones are Christopher Browning, who's a professor of history in America, and Raoul Hilberg, born in 1929, he's a very prolific author on the Holocaust. And he was the main, essentially, Hilberg was the main witness. He's written many, many books, as we'll see in a minute. And the three main defence witnesses, at least judging by length, are Faurisson, France, Mark Weber, or Weber, who is an American, I presume, of German ancestry, and also David Irving. And there's also another significant witness, there's a chap called Fred A. Leuchter, who is an American designer of execution equipment, including gas chambers, for which, of course, there's a considerable demand in the US. And at this point, I'll register surprise number four, that there never seems to have been any official technical examination or even description of the gas chambers. If you look at, I gather, I haven't tried, if you look at the transcripts of the IMT, the International Military Tribunal Trials, there's no attempt to get any information about them at all, essentially very little. Now, I had intended at this point to include a bit of part of Hilberg's cross-examination to give you a change from my boring voice, and that we could have a little courtroom reconstruction on the McLibel principle, but I think it's too long. I don't think there's enough time, really. Anyway, the impression you get from this trial, the impression I got from this trial, was it kind of went wrong from the prosecution point of view in the same way that the McDonald libel trial did. I think it redounded to the advantage of Zundel, or Zundel. Incidentally, he was found guilty on both occasions. I think he was jailed, as far as I can tell. And I think he appears to be deliberately provocative, although whether that's a cause or an effect of what he's gone through, I just don't know. His site has got a logo, which is a white circle on a red background, and it has a letter Z at a rakish angle, which, you know, unmistakably resembles half a swastika, kind of in perspective. And since the guy's a commercial artist, one must assume he designed it himself. Anyway, so the Zundel site was a very important site from this point of view. The other very important site is called Radio Islam, although I'm not sure if it's actually got a proper radio broadcasting department. It seems to be based in Sweden, as far as I can tell, and it includes Holocaust revisionism just as a subset. It's not its main topic. It has other material. For example, it's got the complete text, including a map of Arthur Koestler's mid-70s book, The 13th Tribe, which briefly, more or less for the first time, popularized the idea that the Khazars, who were a tribal group living north of the Black Sea in the Caspian, sort of southwest Russia, were converted by their Khan in about 750 AD. And that's not an original idea of Koestler's, but it brings together the work of a lot of obscure scholars. For example, somebody called Paul Erich Kahler. And it's a popular essay, essentially, in a long-winded style with many digressions, which makes it hard to work out the message. Anyway, in effect, he says that European Jews aren't racially Jews at all. They're a completely separate bunch of people who converted, and that explains their kind of odd distribution in places like Poland and so on. And that's a fairly convincing case he makes. And in fact, I once wrote to Jonathan Sachs, the chief rabbi, about this, and I got a book review back, which began unpromisingly by comparing Koestler to a crab with two giant claws. So anyway, so you can assume this theory is viewed with a rabbinical disfavour. Now, Radio Islam has also got Roger Garaudy's, the French chap's, Founding Myths of Israeli Politics, 1996, which seems to have been banned in France after being published in a kind of discreet way to get around this legal ban by an organisation called Le Vieux Taupe, the Old Mole. It also has stuff on the Anti-Defamation League and its suspected links with Mossad, the Deir Yassin massacre in 1948 and other massacre stories, and things like Marlon Brando saying Hollywood is run by Jews and various unflattering things on Zionism and the Talmud and so on. And, for example, it maintains that the Wannsee Conference of 1940 is a fabrication. It also has, rather strangely, from my point of view, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion are on it, which, of course, is the basis of Norman Cohn's a very disappointing 1967 book, Warrant for Genocide, by Norman Cohn, which only deals with this.
So this Protocol of the Learned Elders of Zion was written by the Tsarist secret police in 1945?
No, it wasn't. No, it was written, it was a thing of the time of Napoleon III. It was mid-19th century, I think. Anyway, there are other sites. There's one called the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, which has a post office box in California. There's the Campaign for Radical Truth and History by Michael Hoffman, and the Institute for Historical Review in California. There's also a lot of behind-the-scenes, manoeuvring. There's a chap called Greg Raven who comes in here somewhere. There's another group called the Adelaide Institute, and I haven't been able to find out much about these things, but that's essentially what you get if you look up revisionism on the internet, and that's their ideas and attitudes and so on. So that's revisionists. Now, we should look at the anti-revisionists, although presumably they wouldn't call themselves that, they would just call themselves ordinary people. Their opponents call them exterminists. That's their attitude to them. Now, the main organisation is called NIZKOR, that's NIZKOR, very unattractive name. And that's by far the most important. There are other groups, for example, skeptics groups of the sort typified by James Randi and, Psychop, the people who investigate the paranormal. I think they sense that perhaps there's limited scope in astrology and spoon bending, and they've branched out into medical topics. And getting into some deep water, there's a book by Martin Walker called Dirty Medicine on this. But anyway, they also get into Holocaust revisionism. And the main one there is a chap called Michael Shermer, who's also posted articles on David Irving. I won't say anything much about him because I think his work is just derivative. And so there is hard copy stuff. There's stuff on paper. For example, there's a UK magazine, at least I think it's a UK-based magazine, called Searchlight, from which I fairly recently heard a speaker discuss whether there should be a law in Britain against Holocaust revisionism. And the specimen copy I bought dealt with things like pop music and Nazi imagery. And I think, as far as I can tell, the titles are repost to a thing called Spotlight, published by something called the Liberty Lobby. I've heard it suggested that it's an MI6 production. Anyway. As I say, the main NIZKOR is the main anti-revisionist group, so I'll concentrate on them. There are various names who are totally described as Daniel Kerran, Jamie McCarthy, and Ken McVeigh. Now, I'll indicate the sort of thing that they have on there. He said, let me see, what did McVeigh say? He said that the Institute for Historical Revisionism was founded by the chap who in 1975 founded Britain's National Party. And there's also somebody called Willis Carto connected with it, who founded the Liberty Lobby, and was described by far the most successful and influential American anti-Semite of the 1970s. As I say, they're all obscure people. The next three I'll discuss are all French. Two of them are French, one is American, actually. There's a NIZKOR site called Hate Watch, which conflates together revisionism with skinhead violence and so on, and neo-Nazis. It kind of maintains that revisionism is in the same, necessarily involves violence and so on. And there are three essays. There's a chap called Pierre Vidal-Naquet, two women, Nadine Fresco and Lynn Collette. Now, Vidal-Naquet's essay is called Assassins of Memory. And I came across this chap by accident in a book by Peter James, who's a chronology revisionist of the ancient world. And Vidalnik is a classicist in the traditional Greco-Roman sense. And his article has references of extremely relevance, really, on the Peloponnesian War, Sparta, Thucydides, and Algeria, and groups like socialism, Barbary. He says, for example, there's nothing more common in history, more sadly banal than massacres, so there's not much in the way of argument there. There's an article by somebody called Nadine Fresco, who seems to be a journalist on Les Temps Modernes, called The Denial of the Dead on the Faurisson Affair, and of course 1990 is the same year as this law was passed in France, and it mostly deals with Faurisson and Chomsky, with the excursions into various French authors. Both of these people quote as their sole witness, as far as I can see, somebody called Johann Paul Kramer, a doctor at Auschwitz, who, as far as I can see, gave testimony both at Nuremberg and in Polish communist courts, and subsequently recanted or retracted much of what he said before being hanged, so we'll never know. The other one is by an American, Lynn Collett, called Encountering Holocaust Denial, and this woman is a doctoral candidate in religious studies at some obscure institute in Cincinnati, and mainly it deals with whether an advert should have been placed by the Committee for Open Debate on Holocaust in student newspapers, so there's not much in there. The only kind of impressive character I'm able to find here is somebody called Deborah Lipstadt, who wrote a book in 1993 called Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory, and she's in the Doro Chair in Modern Jewish and Holocaust Studies at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Okay, this book is very much reviewed on internet. I found about 8 reviews of it. And incidentally, David Irving is involved in a libel case with her and Penguin Books over what he calls her odious little tract. And her books are stopped, but not Irving's, in Waterstones. So I found a quotation by her which said, in effect, that she was not going to deal with the issue. She was just going to say how shocking the topic was. So there's not much material there. Now, of course, in a sense, they hardly need to bother to point things on. There's a huge array of stuff. This is typical, The Scourge of the Swastika, that's 1954, by Russell of Liverpool, which is basically taken out of the Nuremberg records, as far as I can see, and has little original work. This book by both choosers, which came out in 1983, I think at the suggestion of the Beeb, I seem to have spent 5 or 6 years working on it. Here's another typical thing, John Keegan, The Battle for History, 1993. He's a military historian. He lectures to soldiers, and, it's a fairly conventional book. And, of course, there are countless other books of a derivative type, people like George Steiner, the literary critic, Bruno Bettelheim, psychoanalyst, Gerald Fleming, who was at in the linguistics department at Surrey University, who's a reader, not a historian. And there are plenty of memoirs, like people like Eli Wiesel, writer, Primo Levi, who's now dead, the chemist. And there are quite a few memoirs, or supposed memoirs, written many years, 10 or 20 years often, after the events. So in them, for example, we have Medecin Auschwitz by somebody called Miklos Niesli in 1953. And the important one was Commandant at Auschwitz, supposedly the memoirs of Hirsch, which came out in 1958. There's a book called Five Chimneys by Olga Lengyel in 1959. And 1961 is Raoul Hilbert's main book, The Destruction of the European Jews, which has been published ever since and modified partly, I think, under the influence of revisionist criticism. He's dropped various claims, for example, about Hitler ordering the destruction of Jews. And there's another chap, Martin Gilbert's, he assisted with this typical sort of booklet, The History of the Holocaust. You get individuals as well. There's a chap called Leon Greenman who spoke in Conway Hall at a meeting of fascism in the press in 1994, who gave his own life story. In fact, his evidence, if I read him, I listened quite carefully to what he said, and his he spent his whole time in camps and doing things like bricklaying. Right, there's also a huge fictional output, you know, the Odessa file and so on, and right the way through to Schindler's List. Okay, so that's the personal lineup you get on the internet. If anybody tries it, you'll recognise all this kind of stuff. All these names will come up. Now, that's. I hope I'm not taking too long. That's essentially kind of scene setting, really. I've got to really go through now, and this is the last bit of my talk. I want to. The important bit, really, is what the questions that are raised by these people, and what they're claiming, and what truth there is in them. Okay, all I'm going to do is look at five separate subjects. I'm going to look at these following five subjects, what final solution actually meant, problems with the Nuremberg trials, the issues of faked documents and photos, the difficulties over population figures in Europe, mainly, of course, and the gas chambers question. Okay? So, okay, here we go. Well, the first question is on what final solution actually means. There are endless debates, somewhat reminiscent of A.J.P. Taylor's remark on the question of what was meant by plan by the Germans. And for the sake of brevity, I'll just confine myself to the word Endlösung, which was used in many documents and speeches, and you know, nobody disputes that. Unfortunately, its meaning seems to be both ambiguous and also to have changed over the years. It can mean extermination, but it can also mean uprooting. And the revisionist view is that the final solution meant by that expelling Jews from Germany, just sort of getting rid of them. And they seriously considered, for example, Madagascar as a destination. And they also, according to David Irving, Eichmann went to Palestine in 1939 to negotiate with Zionists there for a sort of batch to be removed there. So, according to the revisionists, throughout the whole war, the Germans were trying to expel Jews and do deals sending Jews out. Okay, there's a comparison I'd suggest here, which is perhaps not a very good one, but with the miners recently, the miners' strike recently. I mean, nobody suggested killing them. But the object was to make them unimportant in power terms from the Tory point of view. Okay, they wanted to, in that sense, you know, nullify them. As far as I can gather, David Irving seems to be the first one to definitely assert that Hitler never issued a command with an explicit word like kill. As a result of his ploughing through loads of archives, he was in a good position to do that. And he's constantly issued challenges with money prizes, I think, as far as I can remember, you know, trying to get people to do it. However, there's no question that the Nazis regarded the Soviet system as, in part, at least Jewish-run. For example, in the Soviet Union on June 22nd, 1941, when they invaded, they were accompanied by battalion-sized units of security police and security services, and these units were called the Einsatzgruppen, and they had explicit instructions to kill commissars and Jewish Bolshevik chieftains. So that was what they were honing in on, according to the revisionists. So that's what the revisionists say the final solution meant. Okay, that's point one. Now, point two is the Nuremberg trials. And this is another surprise, at least as far as I could find it. It's very disconcerting to find evidence that many of the best known and most horrifying confessions, the ones always regarded as the damning ones, all seem to be obtained under torture. I asked my elderly father what he could remember about the news treatment of this at the time, and he said the impression that you were given was of a very proper trial, with men wearing robes and uniforms and wigs, depending on their national characteristics. or what have you. Now, none of them, as far as I know, none of the leading defenders that were selected by August 1945, a whole list of them, including Göring, Ribbentrop, Hess, Kaltenbrunner, and so on and so on, with the approval of the press, according to these people. It's not entirely clear what the press had to do with it, but that's what they say. He said that, and none of these people apparently said they'd had anything to do with death camps. The most famous was Hirsch, the commandant of Auschwitz, who is famous as giving his testimony of, you know, umpteen million deaths and so on. However, in 1983, a book was published by Rupert Butler called Legions of Death, which revealed that this confession was obtained after 3 days of torture by somebody called Bernard Clark. This is quite a part of other problems, such as the main document being covered in inked in corrections and also typed in English. Now, it's surprising because this apparently is not new knowledge at all, although some anti-revisionists state that this has only just been recently discovered. This appears to be a complete lie. I found three references on torture. There was one of them, a judge called Edward Van Roden in the Progressive in 1949, somebody called Maurice Colander in the Pennsylvania Bar Association Quarterly in 1947, and also a book by Field Marshal Eric von Manstein's defense lawyer Paget, 1951, so between 47 and 51 this stuff was coming out. And Paget wrote, according to what I downloaded, the commission consisting of judges Simpson, Van Roden and Colonel Lawrenson had reported, among other things, that of the 139 cases they'd investigated, 137 had had their testicles permanently destroyed by kicks received from the American War Crimes Investigation Team. That's 139. Almost all of them have been severely damaged. I mean, presumably there's more material like that, which I haven't checked up on. And it gives names, it lists names. Lieutenant Colonel Burton F. Ellis, the chief of the War Crimes Committee, and various others. Schumacher, Byrne, Pearl, Elowitz. And it's rather disquieting to find that if you look in this supposedly serious book on Nuremberg, none of this stuff is mentioned, none of these people indexed. Will appear anywhere in the book. And I'll give another example of a tiresome thing with this sort of book, the Krupp story. They got on their list of defendants, they included a Krupp, and they included Gustav Krupp, who, however, was bedridden, and he was only a Krupp by marriage. He was really a sort of fall guy. Apparently what had happened was that the original list of defendants used the correct one, Alfred Krupp. But the name became exchanged. Now, what Chusa says is that the tribunal was horrified at the suggestion that Alfred Krupp should be substituted for his father, a practice unacceptable in any court. They shouldn't substitute names. And then by the next time this incident is mentioned, this becomes an old canard. The French is accused of mentioning this, and this is an old card, but the Chusa claim seems to be complete nonsense, since obviously the military tribunal were making up the rules as they went along. It seems absurd to suggest they should hesitate to correct a misprint, so one assumes that the Krupps had, possibly for financial reasons, you know, they didn't want the story to come out or something, the Krupps were not... investigated. So there's another fact or allegation which the American team consisted mostly, about 9 out of 10 of them, of Jews, mostly straight from Europe, who were not in any real sense American at all. And again, the Chusas give virtually no information about the American prosecution team, despite their importance. There's not even a photograph of them. To summarise, the basic claim is that the trials were rigged, and the prosecution controlled all the documents. There was no cross-examination of witnesses. Any written statement could be submitted without being checked by anybody. And the witnesses were tortured. and the procedure generally not mentioned much. I think possibly there's an aspect of wartime censorship. I mean, of course, there was heavy censorship during wartime in all countries, not surprisingly, and one imagines that a lot of this continued afterwards, partly just through habit, partly also to cover up things like, you know, German personnel and patents and so on being taken. So that's the final solution in Nuremberg. Let's look at fake documents and pictures and so on now. I'll just list some of the fakes. This is a small set from a much longer list, which is alleged by David Irving, who presumably ought to know, armed with his card index. He says he would question several works hitherto accepted as standard sources. Conrad Haydn, the Abwehr OSS double agent, Hans Bent, Gisavius, Eric Kort, another author he dismisses, Hitler's dismissed adjutant Fritz Wiedemann. He also mentions Professor Karl Jakob Burckhardt's diary and Hermann Rauschning's conversations with Hitler. That was 1940. A West German historian, Professor Eberhard Jaichel, who included 78 forgeries in a serious volume of Hitler's manuscripts. Fritz Thyssen's memoirs called I Paid Hitler, 1943. Anonymous memoirs of somebody called Christa Schroeder. Hitler Private, it was called, the title, 1949 book, which were written by Albert Zoller, a French army officer. He also criticises Trevor Roper's book called The Testament of Adolf Hitler, which he says is quite spurious. He says Albert Speer's Inside the Third Reich has problems with it, which I'm too long to go into here. He says that the courageous Berlin author Matthias Schmidt published a book exposing the Speer legend and the memoirs. Two different men claim to possess the entire diaries of Vice Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, as he pronounces it. Kirsten Diaries, which Professor Trevor Roper saw in Sweden, were never published, he says here, perhaps because of the political dynamite they contained on Sweden's elite, which included a publisher, Albert Bonnier, who alleged to have offered Himmler the addresses of every Jew in Sweden in return for concessions in the event of a Nazi invasion. That's a small list. There are huge amounts of problems hanging over a lot of these documents, including most of the famous ones. On fake photographs, there's a prominent source on the internet called Hugo Volendi, who I think is German, and he gives examples of photos which are misattributed and, you know, retouched with their backgrounds changed and so on. And also film. There's a case of a doctor who saw himself in a film, supposedly at a concentration camp, and in fact he was filmed at a scene burning corpses after the Dresden bombing, you know, to get them out of the way. I should say, I haven't seen Wallende's book. Instead, I made a search in a public library to see if any... Well, a library at Brunel. I thought I'd pick a typical close university, nearby university. And none of these revisionist things are obtainable at all at Brunel. They're not listed, although the conventional view is, of course, appears there. On faking propaganda, because there's nothing new about it, the famous book, the classical book, is 1928, Falsehood in Wartime, by Arthur Ponsonby, which included an account of a French firm making atrocity films. I think it was in the Bois de Boulogne, which were put on sale to anyone. Right, so that's the final solution, Nuremberg fake documents. Now, population, obviously, if you want to assert millions of people have died or moved or something, you want to know about population figures. Now, there are kind of considerable difficulties here, and this is a weakness on both sides of the argument, in my view, because reliable figures seem impossible to get. They seem to be at where they are, I'm not sure. And, of course, you can make a convincing argument for a good reason for this. There's chaos of war, there's huge migrations, there's also changes of border going on all the time. And also, the Nazis had their own definition, their own special definition of Judaism, which may well not have been accepted by the people labelled with it, so you'd expect the figures to be... But on the other hand, it's also true that these states all had bureaucracies and passport control and all the rest of it. So maybe the difficulties are greater than is made out. And I'll quote his various revisionist estimates for the number of Jewish victims have been made or tried to be made. I think the lowest that I've been able to find was by Dietrich Felderer, who I think got a figure of 200,000, and his source was apparently official UN figures for population before and after and during the war. Racinier gave a figure of something like 900,000 to 1.2 million, and the author of whoever he was, of Did 6 Million Really Die, used encyclopedia figures for population, which he just added up for populations, Jewish populations before the war. After the war, he got to about an absolute maximum of 1.5 million. He also looked at the number of Jews under German control, and he estimated there were 3 million at the peak. And he also looked at Jews who survived, which he estimated at 1.5 million, giving 1.5 million. Instead, you should note, it's important to note that the 6 million figure and the word Holocaust were in use much earlier. The earliest reference I found is in 1919. They were talking about Holocaust and 6 million.
For whom?
Jews in 1919. Yeah, I've got the quotation.
6 million Jews in 1919?
It wasn't to do with extermination, that was a quote. They were using a sort of potential Holocaust they were talking about. They were saying that, I presume they were talking about starvation in Europe or something. Mm. This was an American journal called the American Hebrew or something like that. Mm. Right, now, also, US immigration figures are not very usable because the category of Hebrew, which they used to use, was discontinued in November 1943, according to a book published in 1947. So, certainly between 43 and 47, there was no official record. Possibly that's deliberate policy, very likely, in my view. So, there's another surprise, the sixth surprise, as far as I'm concerned, is that no proper demographic examination ever seems to have been made, absurd though it sounds. Mm. I mean, if you look in, here's a typical book with a typical map, the Jewish death toll, based on 1978, it's a 1978 construction, hasn't been updated for 20 years. There's no indication of sources, and one imagines, I mean, I guess that he's compiled it, Martin Gilbert's presumably compiled it from the IMT figures. Okay, so that's four things. The popular thing is very difficult because, of course, it's in a way the key to the issue, but there's not much point me waffling on about it really because it's inevitably vague. Now, the final thing I want to get onto is the gas chambers. Okay. Here we have translation problems, as with Ausrotten. For example, there's a Gasungskeller. There are all kinds of complications because of precautions against gas warfare, you see. They assumed there was a confusion between gas chambers and gas, gas protection, rooms for protection against gas. There's a literature on this, and the most important non-sort of anti-originist book is a 1989 one, believe it or not, it's 45 years later, called Technique and Operation of the Gas Chambers by somebody called Jean-Claude Pressac, which I haven't been able to get hold of. It wasn't at Brunel, at any rate. And there's a lot of very dismal material on the capacity of rooms, the great dangers of using cyanide, the time taken to cremate bodies. But I have to say that, in my view, the revisionist case is good here. The difficulties of just getting the throughput seem to me considerable. And I should mention, there's a very serious point here, actually, that I should mention, namely that Fred Leuchter, the chap who, the gas chamber expert, arranged, as part of the trial with Zundel in, I think it was 85, arranged to go to Auschwitz. They went to Poland in a kind of secret expedition with a team of about four or five of them, taking separate routes. And they actually took samples from the walls of the gas chambers, so-called gas chambers, and also of the rooms which had unquestionably been used for disinfection, you know, for clothes and so on. And they did this in quite a carefully controlled way, with taking videos of it and also putting their samples into little plastic bags, you know, in a way that's familiar from detective stories, you know. Stick them in little plastic bags, and they took them back and analysed them, and the results showed huge, massive evidence of cyanide in the things which were used for disinfecting clothes, and tiny little negligible levels in the supposed gas chamber. That's, in my view, a very serious piece of evidence, which has caused some consternation. There are several other things which ought to be mentioned. I mean, here we have British Way and Purpose. It's a collection of supposedly secret. It says here that it's restricted on the front. It's a collection of papers from the end of 1942 to 1944. They're essentially kind of propagandists for, you know, the British Empire and so on. Solid British stuff. Very few mentions of Jews in there at all. They didn't take it very seriously. And of course, this is often interpreted as being the deliberate evasion of responsibility. You know, they sort of sat back when millions were being murdered. Later on, what happened was, of course, that the liberation of the camps was reported by, for example, people like Richard Dimbleby. And this is a BBC book from the time, one of my vast collection, including a piece by their transcripts of radio pieces by the BBC. One of them is called The Man from Belsen. And really, all it has an account of is things like hard work and violence and deaths caused by starvation, by bombing and chaos and so on. Although, of course, the BBC source wouldn't be expected to emphasise their own bombing. There's nothing in it about gas chambers. And I should make a note on changing claims and shifting goalposts and all the rest of it. I think it's fair to say that first the Dachau was regarded as being the sort of horror place, and Belsen as well. You had the Beast of Belsen, this kind of stuff. Then the focus moved out of Germany, mainly to Auschwitz, and it was eventually conceded that no German camps, in fact, were used as extermination sites. And the claims in Poland now appear to be generally being scaled down. I mean, there's lots of examples on the internet of signs being removed and, like, the figure on Auschwitz being reduced from, I forget the figures, 3 million down to one or something. So giving some indication of how reliable these figures are.
Plus the camps like Treblinka as well, I mean, Poland's...
Yeah, right. I should also make a point that revisionists say that in the early stages, at the end of the war, there were allegations made of all kinds of methods of death, including burning in pits. This is where the Holocaust phrase perhaps comes from. And also things like steaming, electrocution and gas wagons. There's a whole array of things. Okay, now, I think I've probably spoken too long, actually. I've overrun. I would like to make a point specifically aimed at the left, although I don't know if there's anybody here from the left. Like, nobody seems to have noticed how useful this figure is, you know, with or without evidence, for establishments, whatever they do. If you kill a few million here or there, if you kill a few million Vietnamese, what can you say? You can always say, we're not as bad as the Nazis, aren't you? We're not as bad as Hitler. And that's hence my story at the beginning. I think the left have a grave responsibility for neglecting serious issues of this sort, in my view. They have failed and arguably deserve so. Anyway, that's what I've got to say. So thanks for listening. It's very nice of you.
Thank you very much, Ray. You've obviously worked extremely hard on this. There's lots of material there, and I think many people will be pleased to read this when it's in the Ethical Record. I think there's too much material for most people to take in at one.
I'll produce a cut-down version, if you like.
But certainly, it's obviously a lot of very important material there. We can try and have a few comments and questions. Why don't you sit down?
It's all right, I'll stand up.
No, sit down for
questions. No, it's okay. I can arrange them.
You're still using the recording.
Go ahead, Jeff. Feel free.
No.
I'll just say very briefly about the concert. There's a concert tonight at 6:30 programme here. Next week, 11 o'clock. And who would like to start?
Obviously, this ground it covers an enormous amount of things, but the only original document, or allegedly original document, apparently there are people saying it's a fake, is the Banzai Protocol, the minutes of the meeting in January 20th, 1942, where the final solution was decided on. Well, it's difficult to suppose that that document is a fake from the internal evidence. For instance, the idea that all the Jews should be killed is never explicitly stated at all, but is wrapped up in bureaucraties, so that for instance, the idea is that we are going to use the round up the Jews and use them for road building. That during the road building there will be a certain amount of natural wastage, but natural selection will mean that the strongest Jews will survive the natural wastage of road building, and account must be taken of these is the translation of the thing. Also, the second part of the Banzai Protocol, which is very interesting, which goes into the very complicated idea of how you define a Jew according to the Nazis. We've got a very complicated bureaucratic document there. I just wonder, what is the evidence produced by the revisionists that the Banzai Protocol is a fake?
Oh, yeah, I haven't studied it in great detail, I have to say. I can easily look it up. I think the main things are, for example, that there's no, it's not sort of headed notebook, it's just a kind of typed out bit of paper, which anybody could have done at any time. I think that's the main thing. One of the things, anyway.
I see.
You know, I mean, anybody can type out a bit of paper, can't they? I'm sorry, I don't have the details.
Just to follow on from the previous point by Donald, if you read Mein Kampf, it's obvious what Hitler's ideological agenda is, because he regards them as a disease. And his chapter on nation and race, which is about 30 pages long, about page 252, well, about 40, 50 pages long, it talks about the sort of sociological escalation of the Jews as it will infect the host community and then gradually take over the positions, you know, corrupt the princes and then take over industry, and this quite dramatic kind of long sort of Wagnerian saga about how they, you know, take place over. And it has this idea about blood being polluted, and if it's at any level whatsoever, the blood is polluted and there shouldn't be even the slightest contamination. So that's his view in 1923. Whether actually issued orders is a moot point, but it's clear what his view of the Jews was. Let's talk about the actual technicality of gas chambers.
What point are you making on that?
Well, the point is there that it's clear what Hitler's view was towards the Jews, but it's not clear that he actually sent a memorandum saying build gas chambers to certain specifications. I mean, the actual technical implementation is not something proven, perhaps, in a court of law according to acceptable standards today.
Well, I don't know that. I'm not sure that proves anything much anyway, because, I mean, people said all kinds of racist things. I mean, anti-Semitism was very popular if you look at the 39 Steps, published about 1900 or something, there's a thing in that about a fat Hebrew being found dead on Hampstead Heath or something.
Slight pejorative. It's not some sort of agenda for the.
I'm just saying it's very general. Anyway, that's all.
I thought 39 Steps was a lot later than that, John Buchan.
Well, that's all right. Anyway, there's also a point about. For example, in my view, the Jews were somewhat exploited by, although they regarded themselves as being. I mean, the traditional revisionist view is that the Jews did it for money. You know, seems to me that this is a sort of extreme revisionist view, is that is that the Holocaust was invented as a kind of money-making scheme.
I see.
And if you look, and there's a whole sort of family tree. I mean, there's Faurisson has got a list of people who invented it and manufactured it and tortured and got, so there's a list of about 20 names that he regards as being like a religious invention, right? Mm. But I mean, the point is, and so you can see, I mean, you see what they're getting at. You can see that if it was, it could be a cunning Zionist plot to make money. But from there's another way of looking at it, which is that from the, say, the British point of view, it's an advantage to have Jews, you know, opposed in Germany. You know, if the Jews were pro-German, if the Jews could have collaborated with Germany, they would have been a more formidable opponent. You know, it's better to have them.
How do you mean collaborated? Many of them were German citizens, about 3 million.
Well, before German, the First World War, Germany wasn't. Well, I suppose it was anti-Semitic, but it wasn't. You know, they sort of got on together. It may well have been. I mean, it can hardly imagine.
Many of them fought in the First World War and regarded themselves as Germans. Many of them died.
That's exactly so. And you see, then there was the French. Then there was the Russian Revolution. I mean, there's a good article by Churchill about it. He regarded, you know, there's a Russian Revolution. He regarded Jews as being a kind of little entity, right? Mm. And he thought that they might all become communist, right? So you might get a whole communist zone right across, you know, Eurasia kind of thing, which of course he didn't want. He wanted to be an aristocrat and keep his money, right? Basically.
Well, Churchill was Machiavelli, I don't doubt that.
Well, anyway, I'm just saying that therefore they had a motivation to encourage Jews to be Zionist. I mean, I think the Balfour Declaration was probably somewhat Britocentric. You know, it wasn't.
Oh, it's just a bit of British opportunism, I assume.
Well, I'm just saying that it suited them to make the Jews anti-German. I mean, Hitler, you know, in a sense, it doesn't.
But the Balfour Declaration was about a home in Palestine. It's nothing on anti-German.
Yeah, but that's the carrot, isn't it? You know,
it just says get out and take, you know, help us against the Turks, basically, and then when you finish, just bugger off.
Exactly. Anyway, all I'm saying is that it suited the West to have Zionist Jews very largely.
Just some other points briefly. I mean, Britain. Other points he's going to make. I didn't expect to make.
No, you can't talk tonight. Next is Roy.
One point that came over was that the figures were probably too high. Now, in America, in the States, there's a very large proportion of Jews there. Is there any evidence that they were pushing that to their own benefit?
Oh yeah, I think as I mentioned, this business about American immigration, about there's a thing called the UNRRA, the UN Refugees something Association, which was run by American Jews, and I think, you know, imported a large number into America, more or less, under, you know, wartime conditions. I mean, I think the population of New York kind of expanded dramatically, and it was not, you know, recorded. I mean, I don't know that because of this business of not recording Hebrew entrants from the mid-1940s. So I think you can assess a lot of the apparent diminution were people who went to, you know, some of them went to America.
No, I wasn't thinking of that.
Sorry.
I was thinking of the Jews there influencing the way the ordinary Americans were feeling about it to get large figures rather than...
Yeah, I think there were atrocity stories certainly I don't know if you can say they invented or not. There was a Jewish thing making them up or promulgating them. I don't know to what extent it was invented. If you look in things like this, there are not very many, about four or five mentions of things like concentration camps, although they were not in here, they're not specifically related even to Jews. They just say this is what the Germans were doing generally. So I think if you look at the page references, these are all tucked away in the middle of pages. You get these things about, you know, in Kiev, 100,000 Jews have been slaughtered or something. And I think it was, I'm not sure of the significance of it, really. I think it was, they put it in to encourage, you know, to keep the Jews anti-German, probably, that sort of thing. I mean, so far as that was needed. Does that make sense to you?
There's worldwide support for them as a race, but they have been treated badly in the past.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that was true, yes. I'm sure there's no question there's an American influence in all this stuff, yeah.
Next is David.
Very difficult to understand exactly why the sort of Germans are constantly referred to as having who mentioned the Holocaust.
Still called Germans.
Because if you look, we're all part of an organisation called Europe, as we have been pretty well since the year 1100, when William I came over here. This country has been dominated and controlled by Europeans almost since the year dot. The aristocracy of this country, the royalty of this country, certainly a lot of them. The aristocracy, you only have to look at the old names, a lot of them have died out this century because of the war. Some of these families died out, but literally, quite seriously, a lot of these families came from Normandy, they came from all across Europe.
Right.
Hitler himself is constantly referred to as a wild, evil man who got to power, who fermented race hatred and got to power with the main ambition to wipe out the Jewish race. Well, yes, he probably did. But where did he get his money from? That money came from the upper classes all across the continent, and he had support from this country, whether you like to think so or not. And I'm not listening to any nonsense about this country. I've read books and books and books about this. I've read packs of lies through the British press in this country about what went on. This country is just as guilty and just as culpable as the so-called Germans.
Yeah, you're saying that.
Else. My mother knew Hitler during the last World War. My mother was in Germany from 1936 till 1942. If you actually knew the guy, he came across as a good-looking man with a great sense of humour. Hitler knew my mother reasonably well, not that well, but reasonably well. She and another British woman were sent out by the British government as army officers to work in the nursing area in Berlin. And she was sent to look after the German high command, the German officers, the German high command officers. If you knew a lot of these people, they were perfectly normal human beings that were programmed by the system they were in to actually hate and use and hate us as the so-called entity which we call the British. Likewise, we in this country were programmed to hate this entity called the Germans. We even went to the extent of renaming a dog, the German Shepherd dog, renaming it the Alsatian. The royal family itself went to heaven and changed its name to Windsor's.
Well, that was the First World War, wasn't it?
Yeah,
that
was
the First World War. We named Alsatian the German Shepherd.
I think there's some dispute as to how anti-Semitic the Nazis is.
We have this concept, and I hear it time and time again. I've got films, I've got videotapes of Hitler's rise to power. I find it extraordinary that this is constantly referred to as being a German phenomenon. I've heard that the Germans have something in their blood, something in their mentality, which is there and it can't be eradicated. I don't believe it. I think it's all across the human race, and we can all be programmed to hate, or until recently we could all be programmed into mass hatred, simple as that.
Until recently? It suddenly stopped it.
Well, people are better educated now, perhaps, and people are more thinking, perhaps.
I'm not quite clear what you're saying. I think there's some doubt about how anti-Semitic the Nazis were. I mean, there's a report in Cohn's book on the origins of the Holocaust, which is called the 67 one.
Which was the church, and that's it.
Which said... he said that some sociologist contacted, a sample of Nazis, and he said that only, and got their biographies, and only about like a third of them actually mentioned anti-Semitism at all. I mean, they were mostly nationalists, I think. They were German nationalists, weren't they? In reaction to the First World War defeat.
I've got quite a lot of anti-Semitic material, and I keep it because it's an interesting topic when you come across educated, open people like ourselves. I find it extraordinary that they actually do deny the Holocaust altogether, some of these books and magazines like that.
Do you find it extraordinary? What is your argument on things like the evidence for gas chambers not existing? I mean, you probably haven't.
They did exist. They must have existed. Simple as that. I cannot see how the race.
You don't think you've been programmed to believe that as well?
Well, I've seen them, but they may have been reconstructed out ex post facto, just as a fake,
I physically
see them.
I want to make a comment here that the one group that is incredibly anti-Semitic has always been the Roman Catholic Church. I think if their propaganda hadn't been spread over the whole of Europe, I think
oh, yes.
then the Holocaust wouldn't have happened. And of course, one country that's as equally as anti-Semitic as Germany was Poland. We went to war on the so-called on the side of Poland, but I think you're probably even more anti-Semitic than Germany. Certainly, in 1939, Jews weren't allowed in the Polish Medical Society and things like that. And there still are. There still is a lot of anti-Semitism in the Catholic Church in Poland. So you're probably right in saying it's a more overall phenomenon. But and so it's only recently, actually, that the Catholics in France are apologising. It's only happened a week or two ago that they're now apologising for that. However, I would like to ask Ray about more on the internet side. They've got some way of stopping children getting access to pornography. But as far as you have worked on this, is that is it pornography the only thing that there's any block on at all? For everything that you've looked at, there's no block at all?
It's hard to tell. I think it's possible to, for example, I think if an organisation wanted to block something, they could just, but I suppose they wanted to block something on Timor. I mean, if you're all you have to do is buy a few hundred computers and just log them into it constantly all day long. I mean, I think an intelligence organisation can do that. I think these sites can probably be sort of somewhat sabotaged. But I think during, for example, wartime, I think these things would be, like the satellite links would be cut off and so on. But the technology is very difficult. I've never seen a good account of it, actually. I mean, it may be much more, vulnerable than one imagines.
This point about
Hold on, Ian. Thank you. Sorry. It's behind you.
Yes, if I could just add, there was a conference the other day where the subject you last brought up was mentioned. the person speaking was actually one of the inventors of the World Wide Web from CERN, and he said that there's great value in having a kind of screening device in the World Wide Web, not just to prevent people having access to pornography, but also to evaluate the quality of the material which you're seeing. So much time could be wasted, let's say, by scientists looking at all sorts of cranky reports, which unfortunately thrive in this kind of internet environment. So, one of the main applications we'll be seeing in the future is a kind of screening device, not just for children, but also for adults.
Yeah, but there's no way of doing that, of mechanising that, is there? There's no way you can be sure of not missing something. That's interesting.
It's the same idea as the nanny, but applied to a different... Also, on the subject of the Catholic Church you were mentioning, I'm researching at the moment Giordano Bruno, in fact, was burnt in 1600 by the Pope. And I was fascinated to see that in the 19th century, the Catholic Church had a kind of revisionism campaign in which it maintained that Giordano had not actually been burnt, but in fact all which was burnt was an effigy. So this thing has been going on for centuries, it seems, the rewriting story of history.
He just happened to die at the same time as everybody was burned.
It's disappeared. It's the same thing. Get quiet. Get very quiet.
Okay, anybody got any more questions?
The point about pornography, I was reading on the internet, one problem is they try to stop this stuff by using keywords. And they're finding that serious students of medical stuff relating to sex being blocked getting serious papers because these things are treated as the same as
pornography. Do you have a question or comment?
On the internet, what interests me on documents, two of the principal people who attended the Barnsley conference were Adolf Eichler and Reinhard Heydrich.
Yeah.
But I've never seen any references actually to documentation which they signed. I mean, I believe the Holocaust is just...
I think that's right. I think
it would be very helpful to destroy the revisionist argument if somebody could produce these.
I think, frankly, that the Fonzo thing is a bit of a red herring. I just don't think it's provable, you know. I mean, you've got these very vague typed out things in obscure language. I just can't see that they've got you know, it's just a waste of time. You know, there's all this other stuff going on. Why concentrate on these two documents if you can't find evidence elsewhere? That's my view. I mean, do you accept that? I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's fair enough. I mean, if somebody could produce documents, there would be irreversible evidence.
Oh, the people have been looking for irrefutable evidence since 1945, haven't they?
Did we get that in?
I mean, obviously, there's enough physical evidence, we know, but more work would be done, but I just thought...
No, that's a mistake. According to the revisionists, that is not the case. There isn't physical evidence. If you look at the gas chambers, so-called gas chambers, some of them were rebuilt. The Auschwitz one, for example, is a fake, built by the Poles, they maintain. There is not physical evidence. This is their claim. You know, I want to make that clear. I'm not so.
Were there any photos at the time by the American occupiers?
Surprisingly, there's a complete dearth of gas chamber photos. There are ones of things which the revisionists maintain are either showers or things where they, you know, like insecticide places. And they've made a good case for this because they're not designed, you know, they're not sort of person proof or gas proof for that matter. You know, and if you bind cyanide in them,
the gas would leak out.
Well, you'd have to have a lot of it in the first place. They'd just be very dangerous. Yeah.
Wait for weight, you don't need much cyanide. Especially
well, there's a very long discussion on all this business about cyanide, and a very tedious kind of heavyweight session. But I'm just drawing attention to the fact that in this investigation in Auschwitz, where Zundel sent Leuchter, they investigated, they did this analysis, and you know, cyanide was not found in what is supposed to be the gas chamber.
Could have been washed down by the Germans because they wanted to avoid.
Yeah.
Can I just ask you about, are you in any of the debating groups on the net where people have a
conversation? I do sometimes. Yeah,
is that interesting?
Usenet. If you find the right group and the right subject, yeah, you can look for it. All sorts of subjects, everything from Mickey Mouse to...
Are you in one of these to do with this topic?
I'm not in it. I mean, you don't have to be in it. You can just download it and have to look at it. I mean, the one that I looked at was called alt.revisionism, and it's got a whole load of stuff which I kind of try to... including, for example, Talmudic stuff about things like child sex. And they have this stuff out of the Talmud. They pick out all these sort of revolting bits and make it... And present this
to that's not revisionism.
No, it's not. It's just related.
It's easy enough to look at the Bible and
yeah,
the Jews were regarded.
Yeah, but a lot of people don't know anything about the. A lot of people don't know about the.
Have you got involved in a conversation with anybody who's researching this?
No.
Not really. You just look at the material.
Yeah. Sorry, Graham.
Yes. What are these revisionists supporting?
I think some of them have got a hidden agenda. I mean, some of them, as I say, are anti-communist. Some of them are Zionist, you know. Some of them are...
Some are cranks.
Some are cranks. Some of them are sort of white supremacists. But, I mean, there are some of them who are just interested in what actually happened, you know. And the core beliefs, as far as I can see, are really quite simple ones, namely that the extermination policy didn't exist and gas chambers were a myth. And that's about it, really, you know. And all the other stuff which hangs on to that, for example... There's stuff about Zionism. You see, they maintain that the extremists, so to speak, maintain that Zionism, that this was deliberately cooked up with the aid of the Nuremberg Tribunal, in effect, was hijacked. And in the same way that the UN was exploited for Iraq, you might say, was hijacked. And they had this torturing behind the scenes. They generated these stories.
I believe that.
And then when Israel was founded in 1948, they got all the money. But I mean, an alternative way of looking at it is that, you see, in most wars, if you fight the Chinese or the Indians or something, you make them pay, don't you? You make them pay reparations. In the same way, you could take the view that, in effect, it was a kind of indirect way of getting reparations for Jews. I mean,
but it seems to me, I think the problem that most people have is that it seems to go against all the visual evidence.
Well, okay.
I mean, what happened to and personal testimonies? Well, those who went to those camps.
Okay, let me give you the revisionist view. First of all, the visual stuff like piles of bodies, what they maintain is that this was true, and it was caused by, you know, great overcrowding in the camps. And, you know, at the end of the war, all these railway lines were being bombed, and food was short, and it was virtually a famine. And, you know, medical supplies, there was outbreaks of typhus, which incidentally, I mean, the point about cyanide is that they used it to control lice, right? There's a book at the time by Zinser called Rats, Lice, and History, which went into typhoid. It's easy to forget it now because we have things like DDT and so on, but I mean, cyanide was used and still is used, actually. I mean, I remember seeing a program about gardening a few weeks ago. This chap was saying they used cyanide in greenhouses. So the bodies, their argument is that the bodies were not it's kind of murder or anything. They were just people who starved or died.
Yeah, but we've seen visual evidence of people being shot. I mean, they didn't only use gas, but they used a lot of bullets.
Yeah,
there were bullets are also used. You don't go around.
Well, people do get shot in wars, don't they? War is about people shooting each other, isn't it? Yeah. I'm not quite sure.
What, standing around a pit?
Yes.
The people standing in a pit, families standing in a pit.
Really?
Shot from the edge of the pit.
Yeah, there's no doubt there's some of that, yeah.
Well, there was. We saw a lot of visual evidence of that. That was a known way of doing it.
Yeah, I think I've seen people being shot and falling into
the pit. That was filmed, but you have to be careful interpreting.
Oh, yes.
But I would say that... I would make the point that... Yeah. There's a point that's made by Faurisson that Hitler apparently issued... Irving, it's the claim also that Hitler issued an order saying that this kind of stuff must stop. This is why Faurisson was ridiculed for saying that, that Hitler was, in fact, so far from trying to kill off the Jews, he was humane to them. That's the
It had to be in a memorandum, wouldn't it?
Yes, but I was watching...
That's the visual evidence.
Yes, but I'm interested in the point you made about it must being stopped. It was Himmler who actually issued that, because the men were actually starting to react. Even a lot of the German soldiers found this to be a very unhumane way of disposing of Jews.
It's hard to know. That the point is there's the personal testimony as well, right? There's this and the personal testimony. But a lot of the personal testimony, the dramatic stuff, is apparently obtained under torture. Like Hirsch, the commandant of Auschwitz, was obtained under torture. And a lot of... It was just, well, you know, it just wasn't a properly constituted court. I mean, I've got... No, in principle, I haven't even got an objection to torture. I mean, I can see it in some senses it might be a useful thing to do. I mean, but you just can't rely on this evidence, I would suggest, because of this kind of...
Is anybody who hasn't asked a question
and
wants to very quickly say anything?
Maira Hindley, revisionist. She's the only person to try to play down her role. I never heard of anybody, which in a critical place like a rationalist society, trying to put across that alternative view.
I have no views on Maira Hindley at all.
Yeah, but
what are you saying?
It sounds exactly the same.
It doesn't sound exactly the same. I'm producing evidence that the revisionist evidence that they claim is that the traditional view of Hitler as having a mass thing was in fact not true, and that the Jews were no worse off proportionally than other people, like, say, the Hungarians or the Ukrainians or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but it's a legitimate case. They make a good case for it. It's nothing to do with Maira Hindley.
The last point is Adrian.
In my view, yeah.
You haven't said anything about one underlying feature of the 1920s. 30s, which I think, only from reading, it was the case, which was the eugenics movement, which was a lot stronger across Europe and America then than it is now.
Yeah.
And developed ideas of which people were genetically inferior or whatever, and the old problem of whether the genetic pool of the human race is being degraded in some way.
Yeah.
And it allowed the Nazis to portray Jews and the Slavs as an inferior sort of
thing. Yeah, that's true.
And then use that as justification for whatever measures they took against them.
So what's new about that? The British did the same in India.
You haven't said anything. You see, even as late as the Eichmann trial in Israel, he was apparently using this sort of argument as a justification for the way they treated the Jews. In other words, it wasn't a political decision to eliminate groups of people who were political opponents. It was more turned into a medical issue of we're getting rid of the inferior.
Yeah, it's very difficult to assess Eichmann because he also, I mean, there's all the stuff in Time magazine and so on. I mean, he was a great cause célèbre, wasn't it? It was very much shoved in the press. I think there's plenty of revisionist stuff on Eichmann, who was regarded as being a... I mean, I think the stuff attributed to him was inflated out of all proportion, probably. It's difficult to say.
I'm just not clear about what the revisionist argument would be about this, because this was in documents for about 20 years or so, and an act of justification.
Sorry, what was in documents?
The fact that Jews and Slavs were regarded as inferior by the Nazis.
There's no question about that. I mean, it's the same, they were a racist. I mean, they might have won the Second World War if they'd allied themselves with, say, Ukrainians or something, mightn't they? Yeah. There's nothing new about that. The Americans were racist. So the British were racist. I think. So what's the point you're making? I don't.
They did other things.
Well, our maintenance. There's more. They have more motive than you've talked about, and it's difficult to be revisionist about this. And motive to doing it. Part of the background of why we all believe that this.
Well, it doesn't follow from what you're saying. People are, you know. Lots of people have been racist throughout history. It doesn't necessarily mean they go and exterminate the inferior lot. They just kind of exploit them or something. I mean, the revisionist case is purely that Endlösung meant shoving out the Jews from Germany and combining it with the expansion of themselves, I think.
Well, it's gone right over close to time, so I think we will stop there. At least we all know that this has been a very violent century and millions of people have died in a very unpleasant and violent way, and our species is unfortunately extremely prone to prejudice and wars. And
no, it isn't. It's extremely prone
to the rest of the species. Mm-hmm. And I think, at least we can be grateful to consider this issue in a relatively peaceful atmosphere and continue our work on this. And we'd like to thank Ray. He obviously has worked very hard. Yes. There are a lot of important issues involved. And thank you for introducing us.
Daniel Laboratory is boasting of having made that cyclone or whatever in their brochure.
Anyone could do it. Still could do it. All you need is time.
Turning time.
I'm David Stout. I've actually got
two?
David Stout.
No, how did you imagine David Irving?
I've got quite a few things of my own actually, and magazines coming all sorts of about.
Are you sort of pro-Hitler?
No.
Anti the Beam's presentation of this crime.
I just like facts and things.
Yeah.
I wasn't getting at you at all when I said
sorry,
that.
I just...
No, I'm not.
Are you interested in the internet? I mean, I've got a whole load of stuff which I could... Are you computerised?
No, I'm not. I work on high technology all day long, but once I get home, I like to switch off.
Is it in a cottage or something?
And my father said that.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Do you want to keep in touch with
him? I've got a very... It's a Sunday morning book. It's a Sunday circle about 1961. And it's interesting, there's a lot of the differences between Jewish and it's an introduction from Christians. It was difficult, I must admit, to hear better happen with it. We need to remember to...
Yes, I'm sorry, I know.
I tend to do the same thing, I tend to. But this book is quite big. They look at 1861, and it's quite a laugh to read all the... what they're actually... They're trying to introduce the Christians, as it were, to the Jewish rituals and ceremonies that they go on, but they do it in such a silly way that they actually expose themselves as quite big. It's quite... I wouldn't say anti's. Quite glad to put it. I'd love you to see it actually. Where okay, are you actually based?
Well, I live near Heathrow.
Heathrow. Well, unfortunately, I live in the other end.
Well, let's say it's a place around the end of which part it is.
Interested in all this sort of thing as part of
the planet. Well, I'm interested in religions in general. I mean, there's all kinds of things, like AIDS, for example, which in my view is a bit flawed. Biological research, there's a lot of them.
I write down my...
Well, I'm glad you weren't too unimpressed.
I was
a very practiced speaker.
Right, I can write down.
Thank you.